Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, August 23rd, 2017. MSF medical facilities are destroyed by warring parties in Upper Nile.
For me, it's really just, I would say, a reflection of the violence that is happening. And what it does as the biggest consequence, it's depriving people of access to healthcare when they need it the most.
And Amnesty International says South Sudan's conflict is not just between two warring parties.
Both government and opposition forces have been responsible for denying civilians access to food and the use of food as a weapon of war. And there were consistent accounts of soldiers going to markets and kind of shooting randomly. And after traders and shopkeepers had cleared the area, looting merchandise.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The head of the French medical group Doctors Without Borders says over the last 18 months, armed groups have looted medical facilities set up to provide life-saving assistance to South Sudan. As Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba, MSF's international president appealed to President Salva Kiir to stop the attacks on medical facilities.
MSF President Juan Leo says, "The sad truth is that rather than protecting medical facilities, the warring parties will often target them." After recently visiting Wauchuluk, where she saw a destroyed MSF facility up close, she told President Kiir that the looting and destruction of medical facilities in South Sudan has cost lives.
For me, it's really just, I would say, a reflection of the violence that is happening. And what it does as the biggest consequence, it's depriving people of access to healthcare when they need it the most.
Leo says MSF's medical facilities were also destroyed in places like Pibor, Lir, and Kodok. But the level of destruction she saw in Wauchuluk was devastating.
We had to take a boat for half an hour, then we have to walk for half an hour. That was clear to me when I went there and walked through Wauchuluk, who's been completely burned down and looted. Our facility was a PHCC of 30 beds. It's completely gone.
Despite rampant insecurity across South Sudan, Leo says her organization has no plans to leave the country.
MSF as an organization is deeply committed to stay and work here in South Sudan, to send beside the civilian population and offer as much as we can healthcare access. For us, it's absolutely imperative that all parties of the conflict today respect and protect civilians and their communities. And people must have and must be allowed to have access to healthcare and life-saving services and assistance.
Leo says medical facilities must be protected. She says the war has taken a devastating toll on the civilians in former Upper Nile State, many of whom suffer from trauma.
When I was in the clinic in Abarok and I was in the clinic in Malakal, what was as well very, very striking is the fact that people have lost hope because they moved four times over the last few months and they started from scratch all over again with nothing, and then they have no perspective of anything positive to come.
Leo says the number of young South Sudanese men wanting to end their lives is on the rise, and so is the number of people seeking mental support. She says she hopes President Kiir and other government officials listen to her pleas.
One of the things that I came and convey to everybody I met, and including at the highest level, was to say that MSF is committed to the people of South Sudan, and we could continue to do work inside the country and as well to displace people. We have opened seven other projects outside because people have fled the country. In Uganda and the DRC in Ethiopia. But the thing is, we ask for access, we ask for respect for where we work, for our mobile clinic, for the facilities where we have people, not for us, but for patients.
Leo says the lack of access to people in need is a big problem. She says MSF's clinic in Abroj, for example, is totally inaccessible by road due to insecurity.
Access in all its form. People to access our facilities is a real issue. It's difficult for them. And then us accessing places that I had, I would say, a concentration of community. Like in a borough, there's about 16 to 18,000 people. It's very difficult.
The government has repeatedly said it is committed to protecting aid workers and their assets. But the destruction and looting of medical facilities continues unabated in several parts of the country. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Amnesty International has reiterated its call for the UN mission in South Sudan to protect civilians. Alessia Lodki is Amnesty International's researcher for South Sudan. She tells Ayen Bior that the spread of the conflict has led to unprecedented levels of food insecurity.
Not only did we see widespread and serious human rights abuses, including sort of the deliberate killings of civilians and sexual assaults, but we also documented the use of food as a weapon of war, as you say, by both government and opposition forces. And essentially what that means is denying civilians access to food as a means to control their movement or force them out of their homes and off their land. And this varies in terms of restrictions on civilian access to food, actively preventing food from reaching certain areas, systematically looting food in markets and homes, and even targeting civilians carrying small amounts of food across front lines, with either side accusing the other of feeding the enemy. And these were accusations that were often accompanied by attacks, including killings and sexual violence.
Now, can this amount to war crimes?
Based on the evidence that we have, we can't say whether or not this amounts to a war crime. However, it's an important international justice question. I think that's why Amnesty International has been pushing for the timely establishment of the hybrid court in South Sudan.
Now, how bad is this issue? I mean, can we say that this issue has contributed to, one, displacement and also famine-like conditions?
At a general level, the spread of the conflict in South Sudan and increasing insecurity, especially since mid-2016, has led to sort of unprecedented levels of food insecurity and severely disrupted people's livelihoods, even more so than we saw before. And Equatoria's region, which had historically been considered the breadbasket of South Sudan, and that people there are now facing hunger, is really truly shocking, I think. And I think another thing in terms of the consequences for civilians, it's important to highlight that, you know, people who are in the Equatorias often have no choice but to go outside their homes in order to look for food. And according to one person that we interviewed, you know, if men are caught, they're killed, and if women are caught, they're raped. And I think it's important to note, and unfortunately, as you see repeated in South Sudan time and again, women are forced to often make the harrowing choice between going in search of food and other items to support their families and their children and being raped, with the lack of food often forcing women to engage in riskier and riskier coping mechanisms and tying their sexual agency and physical security to their access to food. And I think it's also really critical to note that in many of the cases that we documented, the final precipitating factor that led people to flee the country was that many people fled their villages after an attack but spent months surviving in the bush before facing severe hunger and fleeing for Uganda.
Who is responsible for this? Who is doing it?
In terms of the documentation that we did in the Equatoria's report, so what we saw was that both government and opposition forces had been responsible for denying civilians access to food and the use of food as a weapon of war. And there were consistent accounts of soldiers going to markets and kind of shooting randomly. And after traders and shopkeepers had cleared the area, looting merchandise, the aim of which kind of seemed to be specifically to loot property.
That was Alessia Lodki, Amnesty International's researcher for South Sudan. She was speaking to Ayen Bior from Nairobi earlier today. While in Sudan, human rights activists say the Sudan government is cracking down on journalists in Khartoum. Faisal Al-Bagri is with the group Journalists for Human Rights. He says members of the Sudan's National Security Intelligence Service have confiscated copies of Akhir Lahza and Al-Siyah newspaper this week. Bagri says the government is forcing journalists in Khartoum to engage in self-censorship.
This is part of the nature of the regime. Freedom of expression is denied always to all the people, including journalists and media professionals. Freedom of press is being killed by the authorities due to many reasons. It's a state of security state, which means the National Security Agency of Sudan, which is called NIS, is continuing harassing journalists, confiscating newspapers, using always censorship, pre-censorship, and after censorship. The government is continuing to suppress the people, to suppress freedom of expression. People, they have no right to suppress themselves.
How many newspapers have been confiscated this week?
This week it's two newspapers. And in fact, there were many newspapers being confiscated. The most important thing, which is not known to all the people, not the confiscation, because when they confiscate a newspaper, it's clear that the readers will not find it on the grid, but there is pre-censorship. That is the most dangerous issue. Media or organizations now, they are forced to practice self-censorship to avoid this kind of confiscation.
What are the red lines for Sudanese journalists?
Those red lines are moving always. It can start with, for example, issues related to health. When there is a cholera in the country, the newspapers are not supposed to call it cholera to make something different. When there is war, you know, now the Sudanese army and the Sudanese militia-supported army, they are fighting in Yemen. Many soldiers, they have been killed. No one is able to speak on that on the media. The media should not criticize the president, should not criticize his family. Media should not speak on corruption, issues related to corruption, and so on. So it's moving. In each and every month, in each and every year, these red lines are increasing.
I came across a report saying that Akira Lahza, which is a newspaper which belongs to the uncle of President Bashir, was also confiscated. Is that normal?
Yeah, it is normal. It is normal. The national security organs, they don't care of Bashir. They don't care of whether this newspaper is belonging to the opposition or it's belonging to the regime. Unfortunately, 90% of the newspapers, they are owned by people who are members of the National Congress Party, or it is financed by the National Security Agency. So, no matter whether it is an opposition newspaper or a pro-regime newspaper, all of them, they suffer the same, they face the same. Definitely, the opposition or the independent or the free newspapers are suffering more. Newspapers like Al-Midan, which belong to the Sudanese Communist Party, newspapers like Al-Ayam, Al-Jarida, Al-Extra, Extra, those few newspapers are targeted. The papers which are belonging to the regime or to the national security or to the members of the National Congress Party, the ruling party, they are still facing this kind of suppression and oppression.
Faisal, I know that you follow the Sudanese media. How would you assess the quality of journalism in Sudan?
You know, the quality of journalism must be poor in such situations, because journalists are oppressed, are suppressed, are not being paid well, are not being given any chances to improve their knowledge. I do appreciate what the individual journalists are doing.
That's Faisal Al-Bagr, director of the group Journalist for Human Rights. He was speaking to me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, this past hour. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, more violence in Kenya between cattle herdsmen and land owners. Find out where when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you feel you get adequate information about health issues in your community?
If you don't get adequate information, it's because you don't want to get it. Because, like, there's so much information you can get on the internet, and then there are information. Even the local people get information on the radio. You know, you open the radio now. In fact, there are magazines. There's so much around town that you can read that has to do with health.
You don't get it because the systems are broken down. They are not working. Gone were the days there were vans going around telling you health programs and malaria controls and so on and so forth.
We have health promoters in our community that tells the community about disease and about dangers of disease.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Traders in the Ugandan border village of Merwa say business is booming with South Sudanese who sell and buy goods. Simon Peter Apiku reports for VOA from Nyumbe district in Uganda's West Nile region.
Merwa businessman Kenny Sadik says trade is booming, especially with Kajukeji, after the county found itself cut off from Juba and the rest of South Sudan because of ongoing fighting in the country. Sadik says the only access Kajukeji residents have to essential commodities and consumer products is through Merwa, especially when authorities lift all restrictions on crossing the border.
Normally, every Tuesday is a market day. These people have the only access to Uganda border only on Tuesday. So they come in large number, extremely large number.
Sadik sells a wide range of products at his shop. He says the South Sudanese who come across the border buy everything from soap, sugar, salt, and maize flour to clothes and stationery. Despite the economic hardships, Sadik says money does not seem to be a problem.
Although the situation is currently destabilized, but these people, many of them still have their animals like cows, goats, and chicken, to mention but a few. These people bring these living animals across the border, sell them, and at the same time use this money for buying what they don't have there.
Every Tuesday, business people from neighboring districts of Yumbe, Koboko, and Arua bring goods and other products for sale at their bustling Merwa market, where large business owners and small traders jostle for space and compete for customers. They all hope to draw the attention of people like Jomar Rifred, who came from Liwolo in Kajukeji to shop for supplies.
Normally, we came here to buy things like food items and then school materials. Yeah, we do buy from here and then we take to ourselves because these things, due to the separation of the war, those things, they are not there.
Merwa traders prefer to do business with people like Lodion Kenyi, another trader at the Liwolo Trading Center in Kajukeji. Traders make a larger profit selling to Kenyi because he buys in bulk to stock up on products for his shop in Liwolo. For Kenyi, business in Kajukeji is sluggish. He says most people have no reliable source of income.
We have things like the soap, things like, sugar. We have things like, I have very many items in my shop. So, but those items we normally buy from Uganda, the only difficulty we are facing is only the problem of, I think the rate of turnover is very low because you may buy, but it will go just slowly.
Achille Moses is branch manager with Eagle for Trade and Investment Company, which operates flights between Juba, Arua, and Kampala. The company also provides a money transfer service which serves primarily South Sudanese. Moses says business has never been better, especially the air transportation business.
Very many people who have that demand because, you know, when you are using road transport these days, it is a little bit very difficult. So they normally prepare flights.
Merwa is located in Uganda's Yumbe district, which hosts more than 350,000 South Sudanese refugees. Juma John, a former civil servant in Lanya County, has also set up shop in Merwa. John's business buys and sells currency, mainly the South Sudanese pound, Ugandan shillings, and occasionally U.S. dollars. He buys the pound from people fleeing the conflict in South Sudan and sells them to traders. John says business these days is very good.
There are those who are buying pounds if you have in big quantity. They are taking it to Juba and we don't know how they are taking. Just we are buying here and if they come then they take.
Most areas of Kajukeji use the Ugandan shilling as medium for exchange of goods and services, which according to Kenyi makes it much easier to do business in the nearby Merwa market. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Piku in Yumbe.
Violence has subsided in rural central Kenya. Thanks to rainfall, national security operations and elections that ousted politicians blamed for encouraging pastoralists to bring their livestock onto private lands. But the northern rangelands remain overgrazed and locals say something must be done to keep problems at bay. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Violence surged in central Kenya earlier this year as armed northern herders brought thousands of cattle, sheep, and goats onto private property, prompting clashes that took the lives of both humans and wildlife. It didn't help that some politicians encouraged constituents to graze their livestock wherever they could find grass and water. Peter Hetz, executive director of the Laikipia Wildlife Forum, says that although the recent elections removed some of those politicians, there are still unresolved issues.
The fact remains is that there are still people with guns and there are still livestock that don't belong here roaming this territory, and the government still must resolve to do something about that.
According to Kenyan Ministry of Interior spokesman Mwende Njoka, security operations in the central parts of the country are still ongoing.
I could give assurance to, both the locals and the foreigners who are in that area that at least security has returned to has significantly normalized.
Josh Parrott, the manager for Laikipia's Mugi Ranch, agrees that things have improved since earlier this year. The grass has returned, the wildlife look better, and poaching has dropped significantly, he says. But Parrott says illegal grazing continues, citing several occasions since the end of July when his team caught herds of roughly 400 cattle at a time on the ranch.
Every day we have issues with cows coming in somewhere. It's just not to the scale or to the aggression that it was in January.
The relative gains experienced in central Kenya have not reached the northern semi-arid rangelands, home of many of the pastoralists, according to Frank Pope, CEO of Save the Elephants. He says that after many decades of sustained overgrazing, the topsoil has now disappeared from many of the areas. And as a result, there is nowhere for the large numbers of goats and cattle to graze.
There's been no good rain in the north. There have been some patches of rain, but really there's no let up for the situation in the north. And we'll wait to see what the new government decides to do and whether they decide they can grasp this nettle of how to control grazing amongst the pastoralists. But if they don't, I think the north will continue its march towards full desert conditions.
Experts have encouraged the government to implement long-term rangeland management practices in the north and to explore options of tagging livestock in order to keep track of who owns which animals. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we will move to Yaounde, where at least half a dozen of schools in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions were banned in the past week. It is the latest sign of deepening tension as the strike in those regions enter its 10th month. Muki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaounde.
Continued arson attacks in Cameroon's English-speaking northwest have prompted calls for the creation of a self-defense militia. Parents argued in Bamenda after their children's school, the Baptist Comprehensive High School, was set ablaze August 13th. Some said it is no longer safe for their children. The burnings have continued. Residents say schools are being targeted for failing to respect the call to strike until all Anglophone activists are released from detention. Messages circulating on social media this month have called for businesses to close 3 out of every 5 working days. Wilfred Ndong is the government official in charge of basic education for the Northwest.
The forces of law cannot be in every school. Therefore, parents, we have advised them to form vigilante groups in the school so that they can help to secure the places for us. And in places where they can afford, let them light up the places. Some of these things happen because of the dark nature of the environment's concern.
Markets and government buildings have also been targeted this year in the Northwest and Southwest. No one has claimed responsibility. The government has condemned the vandalism and blamed it on militant separatist groups. Cameroon government spokesperson Issa Chiruma told VOA police discovered a cache of weapons and a bomb-making factory in the northwestern town of Mbengwe earlier this month. He said 7 people were arrested, including a Cameroonian-born Belgian national who had smuggled his way into the country through Nigeria.
He admitted being a member of the Ambazonia and the main leader of the armed wing of the Liberation Movement of Southern Cameroon.
Ambazonia is the name proposed by separatist activists for the nation they would create. At least 60 people arrested in connection with the strike have been answering charges of attempting to destabilize the country and cause revolt before a military court in the capital. A black and white video released online in early August of 12 strike detainees in what appears to be a dark underground prison has further raised tensions. The government has declined to comment on the video, but the footage has been shared widely on social media in Cameroon. In it, the speakers compare their conditions of detention to concentration camps, but say they will gladly die if need be for the cause of independence for the two Anglophone regions. The statement shows the separatist agenda has eclipsed the original strikers' demands calls for reform by Anglophone teachers and lawyers to address what they said was the overbearing use of the French in the nation's education and legal systems. Cameroon is officially a bilingual country, with Anglophones about 20% of the country's 23 million inhabitants. Violent strike-related unrest in December, coupled with emerging separatist rhetoric, prompted a government crackdown. Strike leaders then broke off dialogue with the government to resolve the crisis until all those arrested are released. A former lawmaker from the Northwest region, Paulinus Jua, says dialogue is needed.
If Ghana were doing a lot, things would have subsided. But you see that this thing is instead, especially in Anglophone Cameroon, getting more radicalized. Something can be done. Dialogue. Genuine dialogue. Comprehensive, genuine dialogue. That's what we've been complaining about in this country for so long.
President Paul Biya has announced some reforms in response to the strike, like a new common law section of the Supreme Court, but has said he will engage in no dialogue that threatens national unity. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that report by Kinzika brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Stand Alone by Kay Denks.
In my society, you made me lose my ability. You made me disabled in mind. Due to old failure, spine line. You made me cut myself out of my youth. As if I'm injured, or illness, but not. As if I'm weak and low, silent, but not. You made me unable to operate normally, temporarily. Unable to move and think fairly. You made me very emotional ill. I saw you need me to be unsuccessful in life. That's why I'm unaccessible. You made me fail to think of any practical solution. Soon own a surprise of revolution. Yeah, I'm standing here. Cause I can do it now. Cause I can do it now. Yeah, I'm standing there. I have to stand alone for a reason why. You made me blind, not to see anything. You made me deaf. Not to hear anything. You lock my nose. Not to breathe anymore. You control my tongue. Not to pain itself. You paralyze my arms. Not to stretch itself. You paralyze my leg. Not to move anymore. Yeah, I'm standing there. Cause I can do it now. Cause I can do it now. Yeah, I'm standing there. Cause I got access to the process.
We've been listening to Kay Denks with the song Stand Alone. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We want to hear what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com or find us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening on this same station for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Standing on my own, living nose in nose, showing you strongly I've disagreed to do, stay with you and I agree. We must leave fathers away from center of love. And Miss Check may come and bind us back in buff. I suggest it must be no. Eyes on me from my top to my broom. Young is me, fresh man seeking for room. Now I'm back.